Okay, so we've been talking about it for a while now, but Ubuntu is finally on the Windows Store.
Yeah, I'm actually quite excited about it. I mean, you sent it to me and said it was dropped, and I was like, ooh, let me see if I can find it in their search engine. And it came up, and you could click install. It was pretty cool.
The thing I heard was it was for insiders only. Is your account registered as an insider when you access the Windows Store?
My account is an insider program, but my install is not, so it's not for insiders only.
Okay, so it should be there for anybody that wants to play around with Ubuntu now.
Yep. Yeah, anyway, and you don't even have to enable developer mode for it.
Is this the same thing, essentially, as doing the developer mode and turning on the Ubuntu stuff through the add remove programs or whatever?
It is, except that was just there because they were testing it and they wanted to make one more layer to jump through. But it's not required to be in developer mode. And now it's still pulling from the same location. They just presented it in the store where anyone could go click install.
Okay.
It still enables the WSL layer and whatnot. And it's the same install that we've had over the years, except this one starts at 1604, where originally it was 1404.
Gotcha. So it's not anything I need to go turn off and go grab the one from the store. It's basically the same thing I'm already running.
As long as you're on 1604, yes.
Yes, that's what I think when I got it, I think that's actually what it gave me was 1604.2.
Yeah, mine was on 1404 originally. And
well, you jumped on it when they first started offering it, right?
Oh, of course. No, but what this means is now that they were promised to put Ubuntu in there first, but now Fedora and SUSE Linux are also going to push theirs into the store too. So we'll have three different Linux bases to play around with without virtualization.
That's crazy that this is actually happening. I mean, it was always a big war between Microsoft and Linux, it seemed, to see who, like, everybody, all the Linux people didn't like Microsoft, and Microsoft people didn't like Linux, and now here we are running Linux on top of Microsoft.
I know, and it still blows my mind, the fact that I'm running Bash on Ubuntu, on Windows. I mean, it's just like, it's like Inception.
Now we just need it to actually work on server.
I see them doing it. I mean, it'll give them so much Docker compatibility.
I think probably letting it happen on Windows 10 is, since you know it's the whole one core thing, I'm sure server has a lot to do with that same core that Windows 10 is using.
Oh yeah, it's the exact same core.
So I'm sure it's probably just they're using the Windows 10 installs as kind of the test environment.
Oh yeah, the insiders get to test everything now.
So they'll make sure that it works with Windows 10, and then they'll start doing like some testing for server OS, and then eventually it'll roll out there too.
Yeah, and I'm sure when it rolls into the server, there will be a lot extra things that come along with it. So I'm really excited about it. I mean, we might as well say it. It's the biggest application to hit the Windows Store.
It is.
But I think Candy Crush has the most downloads.
Probably. That or Facebook.
Yeah.
With Spotify in a close third. But I actually see this probably being more of a benefit on server OS or on the server OS instead of the Windows 10 install, just because it's Ubuntu server and not necessarily a desktop interface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was originally touted as a way to make Windows 10 the best development platform by giving you the development tools on every platform minus Apple.
Well, actually, with giving it Ubuntu server, you should be able to pull Swift into it too.
Yeah, but you can't do any of the Apple GUIs, any of the next step stuff.
But that's okay. I don't think Apple wants you to use any of that anyway. I think they want people to start using Swift on Linux for like web development stuff now too. So,
and that's cool. I mean, the more languages that are available, the better. I mean, and well, with Swift and Kotlin being so similar, and those being the two new and up and coming languages, well, they should push it to everything.
But I see this being a real big plus. I think it'll be more useful to me for some of the things that I'm doing once it comes to server. But I think it's great. It's pretty good stuff.
Now, just there is some caveats to the Windows Linux, the Windows subsystem for Linux. It doesn't do any actual low level, anything that's low level as far as communicating with like the network drivers and anything like that. So, for an example, you can't even ping with it. There is no actual network direct communication, so you can't do like multicast or any of those kind of features. Now, you can do web servers and that stuff, but nothing that's real low level.
I mean, that's essentially what I would want to use it for, is to build some LAMP servers or NGIX or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, of course, the first thing I did was fire up the console and go ping, and I was like, failed. Oh, okay.
But I could see why they would kind of shut that all off, because it's probably using, like, a virtual interface or whatever that's probably just bridging with its current network adapter and stuff.
Yeah.
Sounds like it's pretty much just a virtual machine, really.
Well, but it's not virtualized.
That's great. But in some other Microsoft news, we did a show not too long ago on Windows licensing, and we actually talked about if Microsoft was going to offer Windows as a subscription service and kind of bundle it with Office. And according to The Verge, that's exactly what they're going to be doing for enterprise customers, is having a Windows and Office bundle together. I think it's called Microsoft 365 or something like that.
Yeah, Microsoft 365 Business.
So, I mean, that's really great. So you'll be able to subscribe to your Office and your operating system with one credit card payment. So,
yeah, I think it's really cool. I think this is what software assurance should be.
I mean, it really makes sense because you're guaranteed to get the, I mean, you're going to be, as long as you're paying, you're going to get the newest versions of whatever's out there without having to upgrade, whether on your own Windows 10 or whatever, what's next.
Now, one of the things that is very different between this and what we have with software assurance now, though, is with this, if you stop paying, it stops working.
Yeah, I could see that being a problem. But like you said, as long as you keep paying. But I mean, that's, yeah. And that's, we actually probably should save this this follow-up for last, because it's actually going to lead into our topic of subscription services and stuff like that. But that's one of the downsides, and we'll talk more about that, about subscription services, is that once you quit paying, you lose access to those things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to look at if you're going to be running your business off Microsoft 365.
You will get the best email experience out of that.
I do love me some Exchange, though. I didn't like managing Exchange, but I liked using Exchange.
Yes. And we've both managed that same environment that you're talking about, and there were some really weird things going on in that environment that weren't officially blessed by Microsoft. So I think we got a bad taste for the management piece of that there.
You know, I think you're right, because I actually, at another previous place of employment, I actually ran a Exchange server at the house to try to sort of run it. I think I was running Exchange server 2003 at the time, because that's what was out, and that's what we were using at this place of employment that I was trying to manage. And with, even with that place, like you said, everything was pretty much just straight defaults all the way through, next, finish, reboot. And so things just, they worked. I mean, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, but like you said, I think our nightmares came from managing that previous.
Yeah, and this is such a side tangent, but it's just kind of funny for those that are listening, especially those that were, might have been part of this. That environment was a mixed 2003-2007 environment. And they made some pretty big changes in 2007's OWA, the Outlook Web Access. And the OWA access file, not access the database, but the file that you actually access to get into the application. Me and another gentleman there rewrote it because it was erroring out when anything had periods or whatnot in the subject lines. So we had to rewrite part of the OWA GUI so people could open their email, and ran on that until they went to 2010.
Oh, and that was pretty much a disaster too, migrating to 2010. But like you said, side tangent, enough of that. We don't have to worry about it anymore. We're all using Google Apps now. So,
well, in other news, I wanted to say that the Google Backup and Sync utility is officially out now. Those things that they teased us there at Google I.O., they released it for everyone, including enterprise and home users.
And this is the thing that's actually supposed to replace the old Google Drive application you would have installed on your computer?
Yeah, the Google Drive Sync, where it would sync files down. Now, it does not combine any of the functionality with the file streams. This is still very much that sync utility. They've just added an extra function to it.
And that's the backup part of it?
Yes. What they're letting you do is actually select folders from the system itself. It doesn't matter what drive or whatever. And it can keep those files continuously backed up into your drive. And, of course, it does count against your storage.
So have you installed this?
I have. I installed it on two different machines now.
Okay. Pretty straightforward install as far as...
Oh, very straightforward. You download an MSI installer, you double-click it. Doesn't even require admin rights because it's only running as the current user. And it installs. And you basically are asked to sign in. And you sign in with that same SAML sign-in that we're all accustomed to using Google. And then it presents you with some settings about which folders you want to back up. and which folders you want to sync.
Okay, so it's kind of a combination of the two. So basically, they have a backup client and they have the old sync client, but they've just kind of combined it into one application now, right?
They have, and they've added some other niceties to it. Like one of the options that you do have is when you plug in a USB drive or a digital camera or an SD card or whatnot, it'll automatically scrape for videos and pictures and automatically push them up into your Google Photos.
Oh, that's right, because it's replacing the Google Photo.
Yes, it's replacing the photo upload too.
So it's replacing two applications and giving you a third all in one.
Yes, and the backup thing, it's a nicety to it. I don't really like how it works, though. It's one of those things, it only runs when the user's signed in. So its backup times are only going to be when you're actively using the machine.
I mean, doesn't that sort of defeat the purpose of a backup?
Maybe to us enterprise-y people, it does. I can see where it's fine for the home users, but we have some pretty high standards when we talk about backup.
But I know we have that too. But I mean, I'm basically using some home backup solutions too, because I'm using Backblaze and I'm using Time Machine, and like Time Machine is, I mean, that thing can get pretty resource heavy, mm-hmm. and Backblaze can pretty much bog down your internet connection, because you know our home connections at home, the upload's not that great, and whenever you do fill your upload up, it seems to slow down your download too, which is kind of weird. It's almost
they
like a
punish you.
It's almost like we have a half duplex connection at the house. But never really did quite understand that. But then we come here to our enterprise environments and we could upload and download the same speeds all day long. And one doesn't affect the other. It's just sort of crazy. Gotta love shared connections. Yeah. But Backblaze actually has things where you can actually like throttle the backup so that it like doesn't affect system performance too much. So
Now this does have those same functionalities. Under the advanced settings, it does have network some network options where you can say only limit upload to, say, 1,024 kilobits or anything of those natures. But, it just didn't give you any kind of granular controls about backup. It's like, choose your folder, and we got the rest.
You can't set any, like, file exclusions or anything like that? It's like, hey, backup this folder, but don't backup MP4 files?
Yeah, exactly. So you just don't get those kind of files. Now, maybe it'll mature into something when, if they see enough people are using it, they're like, they may dawn on them, hey, we can sell more storage this way. But as of right now, it's a very new product.
To me, it's almost like it's going to run the same route as the iCloud storage. It's like, because they give you, like, so limited, I think they give you, like, 15 gigs for free or something like that. Somehow I have 30 in my account, and I think you actually pay for some more of yours, and depending on what phone you're rocking this week, you might actually have some free storage. But like, not giving you any kind of exclusion list or whatever, I mean, if I just pick, like, by default, VMware Fusion stores your VMs under the Documents folder. And because I'm using iCloud Drive to sync my documents and desktop, I actually had to move that folder to another location that's not automatically synced to iCloud. So, because I didn't want to fill up my iCloud storage with a 48 gig Windows VM virtual machine. And so, if anybody else is in the same situation, that I think even the same way as like VMware Workstation or whatever on a Windows machine, that's where they store the VMs by default. So you have to be careful. You can't just like click Documents and just grab everything in it, because you might be throwing a huge file up there and you'll blow through your Google storage.
Well, and one of the things, the default folders that it has checked are your desktop and your Documents folder. So those are automatically selected. You have to go deselect them.
I mean, that's just asking for the hurt.
Yeah, I mean, when I installed it, it was like, hey, your desktop is 25 gig. It's like, whoa, hold up. What do I have on my desktop again?
A few ISOs.
Yeah, exactly. I have this one folder called Working, which I think is just where I like start all my projects that I never finish. I think there's like 100 folders in there.
Well, weren't you one of the people too? It's like you just store everything on your desktop, and then once or twice every year, you just gotta throw it in another folder called Old Desktop, and then and you just sort of like keep piling into that one folder.
I used to be really bad about that. I have this external, I know, side note, but that's what podcasts are about. I have this external hard drive that's hooked up to my work machine that I've always carried around with me from my different employers, where I'll put stuff on there that I don't want to lose. And there's a folder in there called Old Profile. And then there's a folder in there called Older Profile. And inside that folder is Desktop and Older Desktop. And so it's like this little tree of stuff I probably don't even need.
It just happens. I remember I brought my email over with me.
I actually have every email from the time I was at the service center to Past Lamar and Modern and here and everywhere.
I do too, but I had to actually create a second account to archive it too, because I just could not take it. Because with using the Mac or whatever, the Mac app will just sync it all. I mean, it just syncs it all. And so here I am with 70,000 emails in my archive. I just like, I can't deal with that. That's
too
much. You start
typing in the search and your computer locks up.
It's yeah, like, it's just, that's too much. And so I created a second Google account that's like Matt Archive. And so everything got dumped into there. And so if or when I ever leave here, I'll just download that account and then just take it with me.
There you go.
Along with my current account.
Yep. Takeout.google.com.
It's so bad. You remember the application we used to alert us whenever we had like routers and stuff go down?
Yeah.
I have every single one of those emails. All the alerts.
Oh, goodness.
I have them all.
Hey, so you're like the archive.org for the service center.
I mean, it's just, but you say that, I mean, it actually came in handy, because it's like, you know, we've been having some problems with this connection. Well, I can tell you exactly when it went down every single time.
That's funny. Search for the circuit ID and it's like, wham, there's 5,000.
Yeah, there you go. And they were all T1 connections.
Oh, joy.
And it was raining when it went down, so.
Probably Windstream then.
So before we get into our topic, did you have a little bit of AMD news that you wanted to share, of course?
I always have AMD news. I love AMD, and I'm sorry that I'm an AMD fan, because I'll probably be disappointed and sad for the next few years. It's kind of like being an Astros fan. You get really excited every now and then you're just depressed the rest of the time.
Well, I think it's been like 2005 was the last time Astros fans were really excited or something like that, where they almost went all the way to the World Series or went to the World Series.
Went to the World Series, and I watched it while I was supposed to be taking a college final.
So what cool thing is AMD doing now?
Well, AMD has officially released Threadripper. So Threadripper... I'm sure y'all have heard me talk about it. And if you haven't heard of Threadripper, it's really cool. It's got a fun name. That's one thing.
The best name in the business, Threadripper.
I don't know. Epic's pretty epic. But anyway, so they're the first two Threadripper chips, the 1920X and the 1950X, are being released. The 1920 will be $799 with 12 cores and 32 threads running at up to 4 gigahertz. And the 1950 will have 16 cores and 32 threads running it up to 4 gigahertz.
Now, if we could only buy something with this natively in it.
You will. Dell will sell them.
Well, great.
I know. And what's really exciting about this, though, is AMD, of course, has their response to it with the i9 chips, which now we have i3, i5, i7, i9. I don't know why everybody hates even numbers, but whatever. And its price is $1,999. It's a full $1,000 more than this. So yeah, you're getting some really good price performance ratios, and with AMD's Infinity Fabric, they're getting not 100% scalability, but they're getting 99% scalability, which is unheard of in the business.
Yeah, so maybe next year when we go to buy our computer rotation machines or whatever, maybe Dell will sell us these and I can actually get them for $100 cheaper or whatever.
Yeah,
because we switched to the AMD processor.
I'm sure they will, because they've already started selling the Ryzen systems, Dell, and of course HP sells everything.
Yeah, HP will sell you a toaster with a Ryzen chip in it.
There you go. I think HP even sells some of those via x86 processors, so yeah, there you go. They don't care. If you sell it to them, they'll sell it to us.
Yeah. But that's great. I mean, I'm glad that Dell's picking it up, because that's who we buy from. We buy from Dell. We're kind of Dell people. And so, like, anything that I can do, because the cheaper I can get the price down on the machines, that means that's the more machines I can buy.
Yes.
And so there might be another handful of machines that I need to replace that I can actually be able to do it if I go to the AMD chipset as opposed to the Intel's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, gosh, with Infinity Fabric, I mean, we have, I hate to use the word infinite because they used it in the name of it, but we do have that infinite potential to scalability. It's just the sockets are going to get larger.
And to be honest, I mean, the end user's not going to know any different.
No, they don't care. They don't care at all. They're like, how much does it cost? Oh, great. We're good.
Yeah. So
now, Apple, please, please, please use some Threadripper.
I wouldn't hold your breath.
Yeah, I'm still upset, though, about their announcement without any Ryzen. Anyway, I'm done with it. I'm done with AMD for today because I could go on for a really long time about a lot of the stuff in it, but I'm just not going to because no one listening to this cares as much as I do about it. I wouldn't say cares, but it's more like geeks out with it.
I'm going
to
continue conversation a little bit just because I want to.
Awesome.
It seems like they're really the only ones that are really innovating. I mean, you're hearing all this AMD stuff come out, boom, boom, boom. It seems like every week there's something new with AMD, and what is Intel doing besides postponing their next TikTok or whatever?
Well, to Intel's credit, they did release their new Xeon lines this past week, but it's a Xeon line, so it doesn't catch a lot of press. So they're not released where you can order them. They've released the details about them, and it looks a lot like an Infinity Fabric clone. Shocker. And so they have what they're calling is the Xeon scalable processors. And it's basically the same thing where they're using smaller dies that give you higher yields for lower cost with a high fabric connection between them so they can just tack them onto each other. So if, let's say, kind of like how AMD does, their dies are only 4 cores, but we obviously have 8 core and 32 core processors. They're just adding them on there and then connecting them across their fabric connections. Intel's doing the same thing.
Well, that's good. They're pushing each other forward, so, and that's better for everybody.
Yes, but Intel's still keeping that price up there. You know, they've had great products. They deserve to make the money. They're the only ones that have been doing it. But competition's here, and they're going to have to bring it down now.
I mean, for how long now? AMD's just sort of been twiddling their thumbs.
Yeah.
It seems like, I mean, the first computer I bought whenever I graduated high school that I bought with my own money and not my parents bought was an AMD computer. And, I mean, it was great. I loved it. It was a compact, but, I mean, it ran pretty good.
I'll say the first system that I built had an AMD K6 in it. So, I mean, I have a long, long love life with AMD.
The old rumor, whatever, was that, like, the only difference between the two was it could calculate a decimal number to, like, another one. It was like 5 decimal numbers, and Intel could do like 6 or something like that. I mean, it's some stupid rumor that people used to say between the difference between the two.
Well, and what's actually really funny is Intel is the reason AMD exists. A long while back when the 8086 processors came out, when IBM was still the king of computing, IBM had to get a second source for processors, because their business customers demanded that they have two sources in case something went wrong. So Intel sold a license to AMD to actually manufacture their exact chips. So the beginning of AMD was actually making Intel's exact chips, just branded with them.
Is a clone of Intel.
They were. And then they didn't actually design their own processor until the K6. Because before then, they had been reverse engineering Intel.
And I know we've had this conversation. It's like, why doesn't Apple just buy AMD? Well, they can't because they'll lose that patent or that license, right?
Correct. And Apple doesn't need to buy them. I like them where they are.
But that may be the only way that we get AMD chips other than, like, graphics cards. They will put the AMD graphics in their machines.
Oh, yeah, and that's good. But, yeah, as far as Dell using their stuff, it only makes sense. I mean, we have AMD headquarters in Austin. We have Dell right there beside them in Round Rock.
Hey, Apple's in Austin too?
No, they're in Cupertino.
Well, there's some in Apple. There's some in Austin too. I think it's like I think that's where they build the trash can is in Austin.
Oh, okay, that explains a lot.
We like Austin.
Keeping it weird.
Home of the trash can. but no, I just I. Let me ask you this, though, okay, since we're still kind of talking about this. Apple uses the Intels in their Mac Pros, iMac Pro that's coming out or whatever, but then they'll use the AMD graphics. Would there be any advantage to moving the processor chip to AMD as well as the graphics, or do they still work just fine together? Would you get any benefit running both AMD as opposed to Intel and AMD?
Not yet. Now, of course, AMD has another series processor coming out later this year, part of their APU line, which is a CPU with a GPU built on it. This one will be called a Raven Ridge. So it'll be a Xeon core. I'm not Xeons. Oh, I'm so sorry. It'll be Ryzen cores with Vega GPUs on there. So, of course, this Mac Pro that they are, their iMac Pro is going to be using Vega graphics. What they could do is if they move to something like a Raven Ridge, they could drastically reduce the cost and the power usage because it'll all be on a single die.
So the Raven Ridge is essentially the Intel Core i whatever with the integrated graphics built into it.
It is, except the graphics is about 10 times more capable.
That's what I need. I need that right there.
Yeah, and actually even with the A8s, the A10s, and even the A12 APUs from AMD, the graphics has always been really capable. It's just the CPUs have been dragging those things down for so long. So this is going to be a really good complement to it and have a good CPU and a good GPU. Makes a lot of sense for notebook users because you get that same discrete graphics performance, but with the integrated graphics power.
And not having to use the discrete graphic to pull more battery power to actually to do it. So
you just don't have to have one.
Yeah, because I actually heard that, or heard somewhere that like if you buy the new LG 5K monitor that they're selling in the Apple stores and hook it up to the MacBook Pro with the MacBook Pro 15-inch with the discrete graphics card in it, that once you plug that monitor in, it just automatically shuts off the integrated and just uses just a discrete to be able to fire that monitor. And so the possibility of being able to push that monitor or a monitor like it with using the integrated as opposed to a discrete to save on battery life or whatever, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, Apple could come up with some pretty interesting designs because they'd have a really low power consumption along with some great GPU performance. They could put them in some really thin laptops and whatnot, but I really just don't see them going that direction on their mobile. I see ARM taking over their mobile line.
Yeah, because I remember one time I went to an Apple workshop or whatever, and I talked to the technical advisor that was actually there giving the thing, and this was back probably 4 or 5 months ago before. No, it actually, probably almost a year ago, because it was before the new MacBook Pro came out, and I think it's been out almost a year now, I guess. So it was a while back. And I said, hey man, when are we going to get some new Macs? And he's like, the next 18 months are going to be great for the Mac, is what he said. And he was like, and I was like, well, is it Intel that's holding it up? He's like, well, it's partly that, but I also foresee a future. This is paraphrasing what he said, that I foresee a future where there's a Mac lineup that's running an Intel chip and maybe running something that's Apple built. And so I kind of took that as maybe Mac is coming to the ARM. Because, I mean, it's already built into the kernel and stuff, that there's already code for to run it on ARM anyway. But I think more or less what it boiled down to was they threw a watchOS S1 or whatever in the touch bar, and that's kind of what he was talking about. So it's got the Intel processor, and it's got an Apple-built processor in it to run that little touch bar.
And to his credit, that is true, but it's not what we were expecting. Now, as far as preventing Apple's OS from running on AMD chips, there's the only thing that really does it is the fact that Apple says you can't. In fact, if you go to like Tony Mac x86 and whatnot, they've already released kernels that have removed that limitation to allow you to install it on compatible Ryzen systems. So, and it runs great. It runs great on a Ryzen.
Maybe one day we'll see it.
I hope so. Please, Apple, please.
Well, you know, maybe if AMD came at them, it's like, hey, look, if you build systems with our chips, you can actually lower the price of your device by $400 or $500 because if they're not charging $1,000 more, and so maybe it can actually drive more sales.
I know what needs to happen. It needs to be the same thing that Sony and Microsoft did for, like, their consoles. Yes, they run AMD GPUs and AMD CPUs in the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One, but they don't really advertise it's AMD. What they need to do is let Apple use their processors, but don't brand them AMD. Let Apple brand it Apple.
Yeah, well, I mean, Intel licensed their stuff to AMD. Can AMD license their stuff to Apple?
They can. Now, they can't let Apple produce it. They can just say, hey, we're going to take our branding off of it. Because if you've noticed, on Apple, there are no Intel inside stickers on any of their stuff.
No.
They've already negotiated this debranding before, so the precedent's been set.
They even did that with their phones. You will never see a Verizon logo or an AT&T logo on an iPhone.
Praise the Lord, you mean it won't like flash Verizon in bright red and white when it turns
on?
No,
not at all. It has not since the day one, whenever it came out on Singular. That was the stipulation that they negotiated with Singular. It's like, no bloatware, no advertisement, just Apple stuff. We control it all.
That's what they need to do, because I really don't care to have NFL mobile on my phone. I don't even know how to spell that. So,
I mean, and like you were saying, that's essentially what they do for their mobile processors. Mm-hmm. They basically design the processor, and then they work with somebody, another company, TSMC, TI, whatever, Samsung, I think even. It's like, hey, we want a processor to these specs that we've designed, and they actually build it. It's like Apple designs it, but somebody else builds it.
And one of the really interesting things is TSMC is the same foundries that are actually producing the Ryzen chips right now, because AMD doesn't own their own fabs.
No. I mean, they design it, and they have somebody else build it. I mean, that's what everybody does. It's cheaper. We just get China to build it.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, Samsung's actually building the displays for the iPhone 8 right now.
Well, I don't want to talk about the iPhone 8. It sort of breaks my heart a little bit.
Why?
Well, I keep hearing that it's delayed. I keep hearing that they're taking away one of my favorite features of the Touch ID. I mean, I just...
Was it the on-screen Touch ID thing?
Well, it's like supposedly they just can't get that right. They can't get it to work.
Yeah, Samsung's... That's why it's in such a weird place on my S8, is because Samsung had the same problem.
It's like they don't want to put it on the back. Rumor has it they were going to put it on the lock button, which kind of makes sense. Like, you just kind of hold it, scan it. But it's like...
What happens if you have a case?
The whole premise behind Touch ID was to set up for Apple Pay. I mean, not only to secure the phone, to lock and unlock the phone and lock and unlock apps, that's great. But Apple Pay, that's where the money is, literally, mm-hmm. Apple Pay.
Literally.
But it's like, I do this with my phone. I don't see myself doing, I mean, I guess I could. That's not bad. And the finger on the back's not bad either, but...
But this is what they want you to use for your Apple Pay anyway. They want you to use your Apple Watch.
You know, every time I use Apple Pay, it's like I get looks because it's kind of gimmicky. But when I do it on I don't do it on the watch, because that's when I get some really strange looks. Because everybody's like, did this dude just straight up steal something? Because they don't know that what's actually happening.
Oh, funny story. Speaking of straight up steal something. I have a Samsung Gear S3 watch that has the Samsung Pay that does like the magnetic stuff. So you can use it on those systems that don't have NFC for payment.
Oh, I've got to see that. We got to go to lunch or something. You got to buy me lunch.
It's really cool. Works on some gas pumps even, that you can, if you can get your watch inside there enough. But my daughter went with me to the grocery store when I had first got the watch, and we were at Brookshire Brothers, a local grocer around here, and they don't have NFC or anything like that. And I went to pay, and I just touched my watch to there, and it went through, and I grabbed the bags and started walking off. And my daughter was really, really worried that the police were going to come arrest me because I didn't give them any money.
I always get like, that's so cool. You just did that with your watch. And some people are like, what did you just do? What are you trying to do? I was like, hey, do you take Apple Pay? What? What is Apple Pay? What are you doing? How did you do that?
Yeah, we'll have to go to lunch because I'll have to show you, because it really freaks people out, especially when they don't support anything.
That is crazy. I want to see that. But using the gas pumps, I actually use the Exxon Mobil app now, because with the SpeedPass Plus or whatever, it's like you can either scan a QR code or it uses your location. You can pick your pump, because I'm sure you're well aware of all the credit card skimmers problem that we're having in our area. So I'm trying to use Exxon exclusively, because, and you can use whatever because of the way your watch does, if you can fit it in there or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to use Exxon Mobil exclusively because I can use Apple Pay or mobile credit card. I don't have that, so I just use Apple Pay to pay for my gas, so that I don't have to run my credit card through a skimmer. That's what I want. I want to live in a walletless society. I want everything on my phone.
There you go.
That's what I want.
I mean, and it's the end goal, but it's an expensive investment by all these small businesses.
But I could do it if we were in Europe, because apparently they've had contactless payments since forever.
Forever, yeah.
So why are we so... And that's why we have so much credit card fraud, is because we're so far behind on those things. But that is a tangent for another day. So let's talk a little bit about subscription services. And to kind of set this up, I'm going to kind of complain a little bit. And if you know me, I complain a lot, but... A lot of apps are moving to a subscription-based pricing model, which, for some things, I see. Netflix, I get it. HBO Now, I get it. I mean, there's no difference between that and your cable company. I mean, you're paying for content every month. I get it. But say you buy an application, and in this instance, this is a journaling application that I've been using to, like, store pictures or whatever, or write journal entries. And I just recently started a thing that I'm trying to do, like a work log, where I kind of write down everything that I do for work every day. And so they've actually moved. They actually, with version 2 of their app, well, version 1, they let you use iCloud as a syncing mechanism. So you could store your journals or whatever in storage that you're already paying for. And so everything was there. I mean, iCloud's pretty secure unless you're a celebrity female and you stored your pictures there. But that's actually gotten better, so don't at me. So they switched with the second release of their application. They basically killed that, and they created their own syncing service, and they sort of forced you to use that if you wanted to upgrade to the app, which, you know, that's okay, because it was still, I still paid, I mean, it was not a cheap app. I mean, I paid a good bit of money for it, but, I mean, I use it a lot, and so it's worth it to me to buy the apps. I don't mind buying apps that are good and worth it. But so now they've announced that they're moving to a subscription model. So basically they have set a limitation. Now, it doesn't matter if it's not for new customers on, it's for everybody. That they're setting a limitation on the free syncing that they've been providing, that they don't give you they took away a choice that you had. I think you actually had two choices. I think you could use Dropbox or iCloud. And so they took both of those choices away, made you use their syncing service, and now they're going to apply some limitations on it. Like, you can only have, like, 10 journals and so many photos and so much storage or whatever now. And if you want more than that, you have to start paying for it. And I was like, I got a little upset about that. And then also in the news story, there's this other app that I use called 1Password that's been in the news a lot lately, that supposedly 1Password is taking away the local sync with iCloud, or the ability to just sync locally over your own Wi-Fi. And not over a cloud service, and forcing people to use 1Password sync, which is totally false. They have not taken away the ability to sync with iCloud or local. They want you to use their syncing service, and they're providing a few more features, like basically it's kind of like software assurance for their application. You're not buying the application anymore. You're paying for the sync service, and the applications come with it. I mean, which is really great. It's not a bad deal. It's only like $36 a year. I mean, it's not a bad thing. But considering when the application itself costs like $50 if you were to buy it standalone. But I think I got it on a sale. But, I mean, I tried it because I got like 6 months free or whatever. And so I tried it. I mean, I was fine sticking with the iCloud sync. And so, contrary to what's in the news, 1Password is not pushing people off of their local stuff. They want you to use it, but they're still going to let you use the old stuff. But, I mean, it just sort of angered me that an app would kind of sort of force this subscription model on you. And I'm going to hold off as long as I can without paying. If I have to get them to a point where I do have to pay, that's it. I'm just going to find something else.
Well, the journal one, it sounds like they left it how it was for as long as it was, merely to gain traction and get a customer base, only to switch the whole business model and the customers that become dependent on that application.
Well, that, and I think part of the problem was Apple actually added subscriptions into the App Store.
Oh, okay. So they gave the blessing for everyone to go forth and do that.
Yeah, and so now it seems like everybody is doing that. And you know, it's like, it would be one thing if it was, I think I bought one that was like $6 a year, or $4 a year, or $5 a year. But I mean, but when you're talking $10 a month over out this time, I mean, that's, and after the fact that you've already paid, I think $20 for the iOS app, and then like $40 for the Mac app, and now they're going to want to charge you another $10 a month or whatever on top of that, I think it's getting out of hand.
Well, I know Apple's perfectly okay with it, because don't they get 30% of that subscription cost too?
Actually, they get 30%, and if your users stay on past 1 year, it drops down to 15%.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is sort of an incentive that you can actually make some money, and Apple will make less money if you can keep your subscribers. But, I mean, there's a good bunch of us that are just like, why are you milking us for money? I mean,
and if something as personal as a journal, you'd kind of want to keep control over that as much as you could.
I mean, I was fine moving to their sync service, because they've got it all encrypted, and they just, it's like, you're for forever, it's all, when you switch to their stuff, it was always encrypted. But now they've just came out with end-to-end encryption, so now, like, the actual sending it to the sync server is actually encrypted now, too.
But it's not encrypted one. Well, if it's just, all right. So are they end-to-end, or are they encrypted stored and end-to-end?
It was encrypted when it was stored, and now they've done end-to-end encryption. They just added that.
Okay.
And so now, the whole communication is encrypted and not just where the data is stored. And so, I mean, they're kind of making it worth it, and I trust it or whatever, and so I didn't mind moving from the iCloud storage, but it's like already pay for iCloud storage. And so, one of the stipulations is if you're moving to a subscription stuff, you can't really use iCloud as the storage, because I think Apple has something against making people pay for what they're already paying for.
And that makes perfect sense. You're not hitting that customer twice, because if it's going to sync to iCloud anyway, there's no point charging them to use something that already was presented to the user to use for free.
Exactly. And I actually talked to an app developer about this, because there is an app called Bear, it's Bear, B-E-A-R, that's a note-taking app that, like, you can use the app locally for free or whatever, but if you want to sync over iCloud, you have to pay the subscription. And so it's like, I was reading through, like, I'm not a developer or whatever, so I don't know the rules all that well, but I was reading through the manual or whatever and the guidelines for subscription pricing, and I thought, I was kind of reading in there, it's like, how is Bear getting away with this, making you use iCloud for storage and making you pay for it or whatever? And so and Bear was a great app, don't get me wrong, it was a very pretty, very useful app, but I was not going to subscribe to it because I was not going to pay double for something I'm already paying for. And so I talked to an app developer, and he's like, well, it's kind of a combination of both. It's like, it's using iCloud storage that the developer has to pay for. It's like the developer has to pay for some iCloud storage space for their app from the Apple or whatever. And then it's partly using your stuff too. So it's kind of, it's real complicated.
So it's like using your stuff for like the settings and whatnot, and then his stuff for the actual data storage.
Yeah, it's very, very convoluted. But I mean, it kind of made sense on why Bear was able to actually get away from it or get around it, because it was actually using the developer space as opposed to just the user space. The user space for some stuff, the developer space for another. But
okay,
my whole gripe about this is, and I know this is all personal stuff, doesn't really have anything to do with education or working at the school, but in a way it kind of does, because how much stuff at the school do we always have to pay for? And, like, are there things that you would rather just pay one and done for? Or do the subscription stuff work? I mean, How do you feel about subscription services, and mainly kind of how it relates to how you do things at the school?
Well, and to be fair, at our school, we try to avoid subscription services. And it's just been something historical that we have here, because we don't exactly know what our funding is going to be the next year. So I can't commit future dollars that I don't know exist yet.
That makes total sense.
And that's just that's just how we have done things here. Now, granted, there are subscription services that we can't avoid, like our internet filtering, our content providers for textbook material and those kind of things. They're all moving to subscription-based credit recovery services like Pearson has with GradPoint. Those are only subscription services. And then, of course, the traditional software that we have to subscribe to, like antivirus and those kind of things. Now, fortunately, with like Google, we don't have to worry about management cost with our for subscription services, because it's kind of built into that one-time purchase. But we generally try to stay clear of them, just because of that the money tying to it. And if the money's not there, I need to continue working.
Yeah, and that's really what I worry about. And we're kind of like the other side. I mean, there's some things that we subscribe to, and a lot of things too. We're subscribed to, you're probably subscribed to them too, but we don't pay for them. Supposedly the state of Texas pays for them. And I know that we ran into an issue. It's like, hey, we were dependent on this software, but Texas or the TEA or whatever hasn't decided if they were going to fund that again for this year. And so here we are, we're like, okay, what do we do now? And this was like in the middle of the year. And it's like, okay, so we were starting to gather quotes from this company because people, like teachers, like built their whole curriculum-based stuff based on this application that they had access to, and now all of a sudden it was going to go away. And so here we are scrambling to try to get some pricing to be able to move that over into our own stuff. But then the funding came through from TEA. And so I definitely see there being more of an advantage of the one-and-done method. That's what I call it, one-and-done. You buy it once and you get to use it for whatever. But the downside about that is, it's like, and we joke about it all the time, because I mentioned your 3560 switches or whatever, and so we buy this application that works this year, but what happens in 5 years whenever we're still having to use the same machines?
Yes, exactly.
Will it still be able to run that application?
You're right. And another thing that, don't get me wrong, I love subscription models. One of the biggest benefits they have is they can have an ever-changing content that you have access to. Like with traditional models, your one-and-done models, you get what you got when you bought it, and you don't get anything new. So changes, you just don't get unless the company's really nice and gives them to you. But with those subscription services, you're guaranteed to have the latest content.
And I like that too. And a lot of times too, like when we're talking like software assurance with Microsoft and stuff like that, you also get not only the content, but you get the newest versions of the applications. But look at Adobe, for instance. I mean, we have a class that we're still using CS6 because, I mean, Adobe pricing is expensive for schools or whatever. It's not cheap. And so it was like, it was not cheap to buy this lab's CS6 installation. And so, I mean, and not only that, it's like you're talking not only the software, but you're talking the materials, the curriculum, the books, all this other stuff that you have to buy to go with it to be able to teach it or whatever, to teach that particular class. But here I am rolling out Windows 10. One of my concerns was, well, is CS6 going to work with Windows 10?
Yeah, and I totally get that. And with Adobe, we have the same problem. We have a single classroom that we need these Adobe, the Creative Suite license for Premiere and After Effects and those few applications like that. But the minimum they allow you to purchase is 100.
I need 20.
I only have 16 machines in there, guys. I don't need 100. Can I have 16? Yeah, but it's going to cost more than 100. What do you mean? That was their answer to me, was it was going to cost more than buying 100.
The only time that a subscription service where I had to buy the minimum number of licenses more than the devices that I had was a backup solution that we went to, because buying for certain number of licenses, even though it was like 15, 20 more than what I actually needed, was still like $1,500 cheaper than what I was already paying for the previous service. And so I had no problem, no qualms at all with moving to that. But yeah, so we've reached out to Adobe too for some pricing or whatever to upgrade or whatever. And we actually had another class that was running elements of Photoshop and Premiere, and they were still using nine. It will not run. It'll install, but it will not run on Windows 10.
And you see, therein lies part of the problem with our one and done too. I mean, yeah, we've had it. It's done. We want to continue using it, but it is still what it was when we bought it, and so much has changed.
But we can't afford to do everything subscription based, and that's the problem.
No, I get it. I mean, in fact, with this video class, we've been looking at other solutions. I mean, I've got them looking at HitFilm. I have them looking at the new Avid software. They're looking at Lightworks and I can't remember the other one right now, but there was another one for free. I couldn't get them to look at Caden Live. They just said no to it, but I tried. But so we ended up having to look at alternate solutions because we can't justify $5,000 a year for 16 machines.
No, it's ridiculous. And I mean, education is a big portion of Microsoft's client. It's a big portion of Adobe's client base. But I promise you that the enterprise and the business side of it is always going to be bigger.
You know, and they need to look at Autodesk as an example. Autodesk gives away every application of theirs for free to education, along with curriculum. Because they know when people get out of school, they're going to go into the business world and they're going to want to use those applications they already know how to use and are comfortable with. So they're like, hey, if we're going to go ahead and give away AutoCAD and 3D Studio Max and all these things for everyone to use, because, man, I'm building future customers.
I mean, AutoCAD, that was a thousands of dollar application, and they're giving it away free. That's crazy. I really wish Adobe would follow that business market.
I do too. And Autodesk, they give you support tools with it also. They give you curriculum. They give you certification tests where you can go through all this stuff for free, because I think they get it. They get that they're not making money here. They're making money there. And this is just building those customers.
I mean, because education's going to get discounts.
Oh, yeah. They're going to get discounts anyway. They might as well build the future customers.
I mean, whenever I can get a Microsoft license for like $15 a core, I mean, they're not making money. Microsoft is not making money off of me. No. I mean, look at Google. I mean, another example like Autodesk. I mean, we get all of those Google the G Suite for education, everything with unlimited storage, we get all of that for free being education customers. But like if you were to go out in business, you would have to pay $6 a user or whatever. And I don't even think it's unlimited storage. I think it's only like a terabyte or something like that. And so it's a limited. So, I mean, but it's just, it's the funding. It's like you just have a hard time committing to those subscription services because, like you said, the funding is not guaranteed.
Yeah, I mean, what happens if, where I'm at, there's not a lot of business here, so it's not a very good example. But let's say you're at an education facility, and most of the population works for a company that's around the corner from you. What happens if that company goes out and all those people have to move? Your whole revenue base is gone.
I mean, we're sort of the same way. I mean, our main local funds comes from residents because we don't really have mm-hmm. a whole lot of business. We got K-Dan's down the road, which is the gas station. I mean,
but they have good boudin.
They do. They do have really good boudin. And mac and cheese, too, the best.
Yes.
they will always get at least $4 of my money every week for some mac and cheese and a boudin ball.
There you go.
And if anybody's up north and doesn't know what boudin is, you're missing out.
Just don't Google what it is because you won't want to try it. And it's really, really good. You should try it.
It's like one of those questions. You don't ever ask what's in a hot dog.
Yeah, or in Louisiana, you never ask what you're eating.
Yeah, that's true. But it's like, we don't have any businesses either, so other than federal funds or local or state funds or whatever, our main revenue stream is in residents. And so, like, we're sort of in the same boat, and so that's why our subscription services are just kind of limited to those key essential things that we need, like the antivirus and the web filtering and stuff like you said.
Yeah, offsite backup for sure.
And so this sort of brings up another thing. It's like, as much as we like subscription services, let me ask you how you feel about subscription services when it comes to your network gear. How do you feel about, like, Arrowhive Wireless or Meraki Wireless or something like that?
Let's just say I don't have any of it.
same with me. I mean, I've installed some Arrowhive and set up some Arrowhive at a school district. And, you know, if you're a small district and you need 15, 20 access points and that's all you need, I mean, totally makes sense for you. I mean, because of the cost model or whatever. I mean, you may pay, what, $1,000, $3,000 a year for the license, for the management fee or whatever, but by the time you add in the controller and the access points and everything when you go Cisco or Aruba or something else, I mean, you're going to spend in 5-6 years or whatever that you get that cloud-managed subscription service, you're going to spend with that Cisco.
Yeah, I'm about to say, we're actually going to have a return on investment where you're going to have to continue investing.
Yeah.
Now, Arrowhive, you know, I'll give them. It's a cool product. I like it. Dell actually bundles in the Arrowhive controllers and their switches now, which I even disable because no. it's an interesting model. I just don't know how much I trust that model with my network operation. Now, I'm a Ubiquiti fanboy too, but I really like their approach to their software controllers. It's like, put it wherever you want it, or you can use our service.
I mean, I kind of like that too. I wish Cisco was like, hey, here's the software to install to run a Cisco controller. Put it wherever you want and set it up to whatever find your access points. There's no reason why it needs to run on that $15,000 box in there.
No, not at all.
I mean, it's a Linux server. It's all it is. I mean,
and if you want, let's get the image off of it. Let's see if we can make it run in like GNS3 or something.
We probably can. But I mean, but like if I was to put pencil to paper and you factor in the access point cost, the controller cost, and then you compare that to the access point cost and the yearly subscription fee, and you calculate it out to between like 5 years or whatever, I think like a school my size where I'm having an access point in every single classroom, and some in hallways and some in these other locations, a couple in the gyms and cafeterias and stuff like that. I have 148 access points. I mean, so by the time you calculate all that price, I think pretty much on paper it's going to be equal. But that means in 5 years I'm either buying all new gear or I am renewing a subscription or whatever.
But to the same extent on that subscription model, they're not subscribing you to new network gear. They're only subscribing you to the ability to use it.
Well, I think it's the ability to manage it, I think.
Yeah. And with Meraki, it quit working.
Oh, really?
If you didn't subscribe.
Because I think that's kind of where Arrowhive has an advantage over Meraki, that if you were to quit paying for it, it would keep working. You just wouldn't be able to make any change.
Yeah, which is awful.
Because I think when they sent me a demo box, which, I mean, like you said, the AeroHive gear is great. I mean, especially like if I was to put AeroHive would work good in my environment because I'm doing an access point in each classroom or whatever. And that's sort of, to me, kind of what it's seemed to be built for, because I don't get the amount of coverage that I get with an AeroHive access point as I do a Cisco access point. And I verified this because I was running a Cisco 1142 at the house, and I swapped it out with this demo AeroHive box because I wanted to see it. And places in the house where I got great coverage, I was getting kind of not so great coverage in the house. And that's just in my house from one access point.
And that's okay. I mean, that's density model versus coverage model, which is a good planning tool.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like, so in my mind, it's like, okay, so maybe they didn't use as powerful antennas or radios in it. And so, like, but it's also half the price. The access point was half the price of what the Cisco was. But, I mean, but the guy, when I, all that to say that, like, with this demo unit, the guy that, the people that gave me the, and gave me a 3-year demo too, they said that after the demo was up, the access point wouldn't quit working. I just wouldn't be able to make any changes. And so as long as everything on the network stayed the same, the access point would still work.
As long as I never needed to change the IP address or the network name, we're good.
Yeah, exactly. So as long as everything, like you said, as long as everything stays the same, that access point will work.
Heaven forbid a certificate expire.
But, I mean, yeah, no kidding, when it comes to like your radius or whatever. And don't ever move your radius servers or DHCP servers or nothing.
No, no kidding.
But, I mean, but not only just, I mean, each model has its advantages and disadvantages. It would be different if you were subscribing to the hardware, too. We might be talking a whole different conversation if we were actually subscribing to hardware.
And I think we would. That would be more compelling to me, and I would really consider going to that kind of subscription model to where in 5 years I was guaranteed new hardware, because that's about the time it needs to go anyway.
It needs to be refreshed anyway, because I've got access points that are over 5 years old, but they're still running and they're running fine, except for the one that died whenever I upgraded the firmware.
Sometimes that happens. I was really concerned that I did that today to one of my switches.
When you try to put newer stuff on older gear, you never know what's going to happen.
Maybe they buried it for a reason, but
but yeah, and so, but I mean, we talked about that last week. It's like, yeah, I'll pay $20 a month for a Mac subscription. get a new Mac every year for $20 a month. I'll take it.
I guess
it.
I just don't, with the software model that AeroHive and Meraki have, I guess I just, I don't feel the value with it, because yes, with Aruba Networks, what I use, it's not HP, it's Aruba Networks, the wireless that we use here.
Procurve.
It says Aruba on it, and in fact, I will not talk to them on the phone if they say they're from HP. They know when they call me to say they're from Aruba.
Well, didn't HP actually rebrand all of their networking stuff to Aruba? Like
they rebranded some of their higher-end blade lines to Aruba Networks, because Aruba Networks got a real good name in networking, and Procurve didn't there for a little bit. Anyway, but I just don't feel that I don't feel the value in those products. I don't feel like I'm actually buying anything except permission to use it. So I just don't feel good. Now, of course, with like our Cisco and Aruba, if we want to keep up different warranties or whatnot, we have to do SmartNet, or we have to do our support contracts with Aruba. Doesn't cost a lot, but it is something we do have to factor in there of a yearly cost.
But you know, also, it's like, I think of it too as like from like a configuration standpoint too. Like for all the stuff that I'm doing on my wireless or whatever, I literally had to build all of the VLANs for the wireless in like one location.
Yeah.
Like with setups like AeroHive or Meraki or whatever, you're basically, you're trunking ports to access points and setting up those VLANs in every single switch. And so, I mean, from a configuration standpoint, our model or of a controller, of an on-site controller access point model or whatever, it's a little bit easier to do as far as configuration goes. But, I mean...
Yeah, and with the model that we have, we get some inherent benefits like that of traffic inspection and those kind of things. We can do it at a deeper level because we're not relying on the CPU of a little access point to do it.
Yeah, I mean, everything's tunneling back to a piece of hardware that's actually, like you say, got some better gear in it. But also, I mean, another thing that I kind of worry about when we talk about like those sorts of things, it's like you get all those fancy graphs and everything, all that information or whatever. I know it's probably not much, but it always, how much overhead to get that kind of information is that access point needing as far as like CPU processing to be able to gather all that and log it and send it or whatever, And not only that, but also like the network traffic that it's using to actually send those logs. I mean, that's I know it's probably like negligible. Is that the word I'm looking for? Negligible?
Yeah, negligible.
And I'm probably just like worried about it for no reason. But I mean, it's like I want the most bang for my buck. And it's like I want my traffic on that thing and not.
And well, actually, Aruba Networks ran into this issue with one of their models. They have the AP105 from a couple years ago. It's an ABGN access point. And right after those released, they had an instant series that could run controllerless, where the controller was actually distributed between all the access points. And they had to upgrade the CPUs and memories in all of the access points because the prior model didn't have it. So like the IAP105 could do it, but the AP105 could not. But then also the IAP105 could be run in the traditional model or the clustered controller model. So, I mean, yeah, the cost of that other one costs more for them, though. So, I mean, it's not something you can just throw out there and say, no, it's not a concern, because, no, it is a concern, and companies have ran into those problems.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, a school district guy told me that's like, well, we just put in a whole bunch of Meraki stuff, and I just hung my head, because I was like, I mean, why? I mean, you're looking at and he did the cost out or whatever, but what happens in 3 to 5 years whenever the funds aren't there to pay for it? What happens to network gear?
Or what happens if you have a really bad configuration error that takes your internet connection down and you need to change it to get it back up?
And the only way to change it is over the internet. I mean... No, we could be joking and be completely wrong about that. You could probably still do some things local on the device itself, but I mean it's the premise.
Yeah, you can. It won't let you brick it quite that bad, but it is a fun scenario to talk about.
It's a premise. It's like, what happens if you brick your gear that's controlled with a cloud controller and you can't access your cloud?
Well, hey, what remember last year Nest? They had an outage on one of their servers and nobody could turn their heaters on up north because all the Nest thermostats couldn't turn on.
I mean, I remember that. I mean, that's just nuts. I mean, so I guess when it comes to network gear, I mean, I guess we're not real big fans of subscription models. I mean, but unless, like I said, unless you're a smaller school and it works out for you. I mean, like, but the amount of access points that we need, I mean, it just doesn't really kind of make sense for us.
If it eases your management and lets you do your job more efficiently without spending too much more, I'd say it's okay.
But I just don't know how I feel about being reliant on the cloud to control my internet access.
I don't want it to rain on my switches.
Yeah. I'm a control freak when it comes to my network gear, so.
I like subscription models for software. Hardware? No.
Software, I mean, it's great. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I started the whole conversation off complaining about an application because I didn't like the fact that it's like, hey, now we're going to impose these limitations and try to go back and it's like, hey, if you want to, I mean, I don't like apps. It's like, hey, it would be different if it was like the app version 3 or whatever. It's like, hey, if you want to do the new version of the app, you have to switch to the subscription model. You can download the app for free, but then you have to pay for the subscription. That's one thing. That is one thing. Don't get me wrong. But like to add the subscription on top of an application that you already bought, that's to me that's a little shady in a way.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely.
But I mean, I like you said, I like software subscriptions too. Even like personal stuff. I mean, if I could afford to pay subscriptions for everything, that means that I know that it's like you're almost guaranteeing future development of your application. You're guaranteeing new features. You're guaranteeing like the one thing I love about the. I mean, I subscribe to Adobe. I mean, we talked about how you did last year. I only subscribe to the Photoshop plan, the one that's like $10 a month, whether you're an educator or not. I mean, it's like, hey, if you're an educator, sign up for the photography only for $9.99. So you go back to the non-educator, it's like $9.99. It's like, why advertise it as something special for educator when it's the same? And so I subscribe to that because it's like, okay, so essentially I'm going to pay. And the one I signed up for, I don't know about yours, but you're basically guaranteed for a year. It's like...
For a year. But, to their mistake, I have unlimited access to email accounts.
So, I mean, it's like, well, the $20 one that you signed up for that's only good for a year. But, I mean, I'm talking like the whole plan. It's like, I have basically guaranteed to pay Adobe $120 is basically what I did.
Yes. And that's not bad if you want to have the latest version. Because even if you were going to use Photoshop Express, you were going to be paying $75 at least a year to stay up to date on it.
And that's what I looked at. It's like a version of Photoshop fell off a truck in front of my house a long time ago that I had been using for forever. And it's like Photoshop is one of those applications that, you know, like every year or two, boom, here comes a new one. Here's a new one. And ever since they moved to the Creative Cloud, it's almost like every year and a half, or no, actually every year there's a new version.
Every year.
And so $120 a year, I am getting a $900 application, a new version, for $120 a year when they're cranking them out once a year now.
And I really feel that that's a pretty good value, the Adobe subscriptions for those things, because you not only get Photoshop, you get Lightroom and some cloud storage with it.
The only thing I wish would happen is like, okay, after I've committed for a year and they can kind of see, okay, look, I'm committed for a year, I wish they would give me the option to be able to, I guess, like pause the subscription or cancel on demand, because with it, it's like, it's basically like you quit paying for it, it quits working, just like that Microsoft 365 subscription we talked about earlier. So like if I was to quit paying for the Photoshop, like, hey, I need Photoshop for this month for this project or whatever. I'm going to make some new podcast artwork or whatever. And so it's like, hey, I'm going to get Photoshop. I'm going to pay my $10 a month for 1 month or whatever. But no, I think if you cancel, you have to like pay at least 6 months worth. So, I mean, you're promised at least $60 and it's going to quit working.
Now, Adobe does have this really cool version that works for 14 days at a time that you can keep uninstalling and reinstalling over and over.
The trial?
Yeah. Oh, not the trial. No, it's a 14-day edition of Photoshop.
Oh, sweet. With access to unlimited email accounts. You basically got just every 14 days. Well, at least it's better than every 10 minutes.
Just a little tip for everybody. If you don't know and you use Google, you can put a plus sign at the end of your email address and tack on any number, and it'll still go to your normal mailbox, but it looks like a different email address to companies.
I did not know that.
There you go.
Problem solved. I'm switching to the 14-day version. But no, I don't mind paying. Like I said earlier, I don't mind paying for applications that I use, like Photoshop. I don't know if I'm going to subscribe to this journaling application because, I mean, I use it, but I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a while before I actually reach the limits that they imposed. So, I mean, I'm not too concerned about that. I'm not using the 1Password subscription because I looked into it because I have like a Windows desktop up here that I use, and so it would have been nice to have access to all my passwords and stuff on that machine too. But it's like, you know what? My phone is right beside me. I'll just pull them up on my phone real quick. And so I'm not switching to that. Netflix, yeah, that's a guaranteed. I'm paying for that every month. Guaranteed. And so,
how else are we going to watch My Little Pony in my house? Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't mind paying for subscription stuff that we use or whatever. I just have a problem. Like if they're charging me for something I've already bought, if that makes sense. Yeah. I have a problem with that.
No, I agree. I am all for supporting companies and developers on a subscription model if I can perceive a value with it. The second that I feel like I'm being cheated more than I'm getting, that's where I start having a problem.
And when it comes to school stuff, I mean, it's like you said, it's one thing that you try to shy away from because you can't guarantee the funding, which, I mean, in the long run probably sets us up for more trouble than what it's worth. I mean, we're sort of in the same boat. I think the main subscription things like we have are like the antivirus, the web filter. I don't have one of those firewalls that I have to pay yearly for. which, I mean, those things are pretty cool though. Don't get me wrong. I would love a Fortinet. But I'll build my own before I pay for that. But it's like, I mean, I'm using since I redid some labs or whatever, I installed a typing application for a keyboarding class that I think was made in 2005. I installed it, and when that's going to quit working, I don't know. Is it going to work fully with Windows 10? I don't know. I guess we'll just have to find out. I mean, I'm waiting on the new budget year rolls around so we can actually buy the new version of Elements for this one class so they can actually do their work, because I told my supervisors, like, there's just no way I can get this to work. It just will not work. And it's like, and you Google it online and they're like, it's not going to work. And even like Adobe support forms, it's not going to work. And you can't call Adobe for support because the application's 15 years old.
They're going to be like, I didn't know it still ran.
I was building some installers for CS6 and I had some questions. And it's like, so I kind of reached out to him with support. It's like, well, the best we can do for you is like email support. And that may be once every 48 hours, they'll actually respond to it. So it's like, well, I just sort of figured it out on my own.
Yeah. And, well, you know, I wonder if you could use those same tools to Automate a 13-day reinstall.
I mean, can you use, like, Fog to, like, re-image the machine every 13 days?
You could.
It's like, just set it on a schedule. On the 13th day, every night, just re-image.
No, we jest, only because it's something that might be possible to do. But no, we're not really going to go do
no,
this.
No, because it seems it's because that would just make more work for us, and it's not worth it. I wish we had the funds to be able to get the Adobe subscriptions that we need and to get the subscriptions to the applications. So Adobe, if you're listening, follow Autodesk's example.
Yeah, or at least make a lesser expensive version that I don't have to buy 100 of at a time.
Yeah.
Because I only have 16 machines. I don't need 100.
No. Well, go ahead and do 17 so you can get it on yours too.
There you go. Well, I guess I can install it 4 times on each one, right?
Always, right? How many activations do you get with one Mac key? you buy one Windows license and you get, what, 15 activations with it?
Something like that.
Well, I mean, do you have anything else you want to add about subscription services? I mean, I guess it depends on what it is, whether we like it or not, really.
No, and I don't want it to come across that I'm totally opposed to subscriptions, because I know it may have sounded like that with our school, but I'm really not. I just need a really high perceived value in order to consider a subscription model, opposed to something that I can buy and have that's going to keep running.
I mean, it's got to be as important as Eduphoria.
Except stay up longer.
I know, that was a joke. I mean, there's just those things, it's like, you have to pay for them every year. I mean, you don't have the school agreement with Microsoft. I mean, that's actually something we actually switched to, and come to find out, that's actually been a little bit more beneficial for us. But,
and honestly, I would like to have that model, and I'm looking at with my leftover funds that I have this year, being I started a one-to-one program and a bunch of other stuff. If I have enough funds left for this year to pay for it, I'm probably going to do the enrollment, because I would really love the other benefits to it, along with not having to worry, not having to be so meticulous about maintaining validity of my license.
And it's like you're sort of limited on the actual... Well, I know with Windows 7, you were probably limited on the actual ISO that you could actually install Windows with.
Yes.
Because I don't think you could use the sticker, the key that's on the sticker on the box, with a volume license ISO or disk that you've installed with. I think that's different with Windows 10 now, but I know there were some differences between XP and 7.
Well, and we buy refurbished machines, and Microsoft actually has a refurbisher program to where that machine gets a separate, it's a brown sticker instead of a blue sticker, for a license key for that particular machine. And what it does is it takes into account the hardware IDs of that machine, whether it can activate or not.
I did discover, though, I mean, this may actually come in handy with you, and if you actually switch to the school agreement method, the VMAT tool, the Volume Activation Management tool, I think version 3.1 or whatever, it will actually convert OEM keys to volume license keys.
Oh, yeah, you can right-click on it and say install new key.
Yes, and so that makes it a lot easier, because I think there was a handful of, like, principal machines or something out there that were like, why are they using OEM keys? I was like, add volume license key, activate.
Yeah, and another thing you can do when you do move to Windows 10, and if you want Office 16, you can do that Active Directory activation, to where it'll have a DNS record in your environment that piece of software goes and checks for activation.
Dude, that is the best.
Oh, it's awesome, isn't it? As soon as you join it to the domain, it's like, activated.
For a while, I cheated and didn't sysprep Windows 7 for a long time. And so that broke KMS. And so it's like you set up, I mean, KMS was great when it worked. It's kind of like WSUS. And so, but like if you didn't sysprep or whatever, you had to go manually activate with the volume management activation tool. I mean, it would work, but you just have to manually do it. And so it's like I would set up all these labs and then I would go manually activate Windows. With Windows 10 and Active Directory-based application, I just install Windows, I install Office, and don't open it if you're imaging. I still sysprep, because I want WSUS to report right, and I think something else. No, it was KMS and WSUS that still want sysprep. Once those two things go away or start using other things, it's okay to not sysprep, I guess. But especially if you're using like machines or whatever, and so all the hardware's the same, you're not really pushing out, making it force for new drivers or whatever. But it's like, you join to the domain, boom, everything's activated. You're not limited on, like, you have to get 25 computers online to be able to activate Windows and then 5 of them to do Office or whatever.
Or you run KMS Pico.
And so it's like, as long as that machine connects to the domain every once every 180 days, you're good.
Mm-hmm. And I feel that that's been a great move for Microsoft, because that is how it should work. This machine's on my domain. I've authorized it to be here. That software is activated under me.
And
once it destroys from the domain, it's not activated anymore. It seems like they retain more control over the product, but make it easier on you too.
Yeah, but you know, just to try to sell you on the school agreement or whatever, you know about all the extra stuff that you'll get when you mm-hmm. come with it. It's like, apparently I have access to SQL Server now. So I mean, that's yeah. great, and system management. So if you want to get school agreement and you want to lower the price, just fire some of your teachers.
Well, you know, that may be a couple of years anyway, with the way the TEA is going anyway.
Because it's like you pay for your school agreement based on your
based on full-time employment.
Yeah, full-time employment employees or whatever. So you're not paying based on student, you're based on adults. And so just lower that number and you'll get your price down for your Microsoft software.
We only have 10 employees here. Never mind, there's 1,500 kids.
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking about? We only have 10 employees. Our student-to-teacher ratio is fantastic.
The students teach themselves.
Well, I mean, what's considered full time?
Well, they actually, you have to do full time. It's anyone who is 32 hours or more. But then, and then you also have to count the part time people too. There's a formula that they give you for it.
Yeah, it's like 2 part time people equal 1 full time person, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
Yes,
2/5.
So I think we're paying for like 200 employees or something like that. 180, something like that. Not bad. So, I mean, but it's worth it. You should move it. Find the software. Start selling some old gear and try to come up with the pricing.
I wish they would let me sell old gear. The only thing they'll let me do is auction it off. And have you ever auctioned anything off from a school?
No, we just, look, this is what we do. We have this magical blue box outside. No, in all seriousness, though, we have a company that comes in and salvages all of our stuff, stuff that's not bought with like federal funds or if it's past the federal limit or whatever.
Do they give you credit or anything for it?
I think they give you a little bit of cash.
Okay. Yeah, because I wanted to get rid of, I have some old Aruba controllers and switches and whatnot we were discussing, and my financial guy said I had to auction them off, but I'm not even guaranteed a penny for it when I do that.
I think, the guy that came out here actually said he spoke to you, so you probably have spoken to the company that we've used as far as yeah. that salvage stuff. But yeah, I mean,
was it Bass?
No, it was this new people. I think he used to okay. work for Bass, but I mean, I think he's out of like Longview or something like that.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about now. I did talk to him.
Very energetic guy.
Very.
But it's like he was like, call us, we'll send you a pallet in a box. You fill it up, we'll come back out the next day and get it. So I mean, it was like. Or if you got a bunch of stuff, we'll send a box truck. So, and they come load it all up and haul it away and send us a check for $400 or $500. So,
yeah, we had one come in and take all our stuff, but they didn't give us any money.
That's rough. But you know what? That may be almost worth it.
It was worth it in this case because you know me, how far I'm going to make something keep working. This stuff was not going to work again.
No more. You couldn't solder the fans onto the CPU anymore at this point, right?
Oh, dude, you jest, but it does happen here.
But that's our show for this week. If you have any questions or feedback or anything you want to ask us involving subscription services or anything we may use or anything like that, you can reach out to us on Twitter. Chris can be found at @Feeks, and I am at @TwistOfMatt. You can also reach out to the show account at @EducatingTech. You can also send us an email to educatingtech@gmail.com. For more episodes, visit educatingtech.net. You can also find links to subscribe or contact us there or have the podcast episodes dropped into your favorite podcast app automatically. So that's it for this week. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Adios, Chris.
See you later, Matt.